I am a man who dresses in the dark. She heard him, knowing full well that not one of those noises was indispensable, and that he made them on purpose, although he pretended not to, just as she was awake and pretended not to be. His motives were clear. He never needed her awake and lucid as much as he did during those fumbling moments. There was no sleeper more elegant than she, with her curved body posed for a dance and her hand across her forehead. But there was also no one more ferocious when anyone disturbed the sensuality of her thinking she was still asleep when she no longer was. Dr. Urbino knew she was waiting for his slightest sound, that she even would be grateful for it, just so she could blame someone for waking her at 5 o'clock in the morning, so that on the few occasions when he had to feel around in the dark because he could not find his slippers in their customary place, she would suddenly say in a sleepy voice, "You left them in the bathroom last night." Then right after that, her voice fully awake with rage, she would curse, "The worst misfortune in this house is that nobody lets you sleep." Then she would roll over in bed and turn on the light without the least mercy for herself, content with her first victory of the day. The truth was they both played a game, mythical and perverse, but for all that, comforting. It was one of the many dangerous pleasures of domestic love. But one of those trivial games almost ended the first 30 years of their life together, because one day there was no soap in the bathroom. It began with routine simplicity. Dr. Juvenal Urbino had returned to the bedroom, in the days when he still bathed without help, and begun to dress without turning on the light. As usual, she was in her warm, fetal state, her eyes closed, her breathing shallow, that arm from a sacred dance above her head. But she was only half asleep, as usual, and he knew it. After a prolonged sound of starched linen in the darkness, Dr. Urbino said to himself, "I've been bathing for almost a week without any soap." Then, fully awake, she remembered, and tossed and turned in fury with the world because, in fact, she had forgotten to replace the soap in the bathroom. She had noticed its absence 3 days earlier when she was already under the shower, and she had planned to replace it afterward, but then she forgot until the next day, and on the third day the same thing happened again. The truth was that a week had not gone by, as he said to make her feel more guilty, but 3 unpardonable days, and her anger at being found out in a mistake maddened her. As always, she defended herself by attacking. "Well, I've bathed every day," she shouted, beside herself with rage, "and there's always been soap." Although he knew her battle tactics by heart, this time he could not abide them. On some professional pretext or other, he went to live in the intern's quarters at Misericordia Hospital, returning home only to change his clothes before making his evening house calls. She headed for the kitchen when she heard him come in, pretending that she had something to do, and stayed there until she heard his carriage in the street. For the next 3 months, each time they tried to resolve the conflict, they only inflamed their feelings even more. He was not ready to come back as long as she refused to admit there had been no soap in the bathroom, and she was not prepared to have him back until he recognized that he had consciously lied to torment her. The incident, of course, gave them the opportunity to evoke many other trivial quarrels from many other dim and turbulent dawns. Resentments stirred up other resentments, reopened old scars, turned them into fresh wounds, and both were dismayed at the desolating proof that in so many years of conjugal battling, they had done little more than nurture their rancor. At last, he proposed that they both submit to an open confession, with the Archbishop himself if necessary, so that God could decide once and for all whether or not there had been soap in the soap dish in the bathroom. Then, despite all her self-control, she lost her temper with a historic cry, "To hell with the Archbishop!" The impropriety shook the very foundations of the city, gave rise to slanders that were not easy to disprove, and was preserved in popular tradition as if it were a line from an operetta. To hell with the archbishop! Realizing she had gone too far, she anticipated her husband's predictable response and threatened to move back to her father's old house, which still belonged to her, although it had been rented out for public offices, and lived there by herself. And it was not an idle threat. She really did want to leave, and did not care about the scandal, and her husband realized this in time. He did not have the courage to defy his own prejudices, and he capitulated. Not in the sense that he admitted there had been soap in the bathroom, but in so far as he continued to live in the same house with her, although they slept in separate rooms, and he did not say a word to her. They ate in silence, sparring with so much skill that they sent each other messages across the table through the children, and the children never realized that they were not speaking to each other. Since the study had no bathroom, the arrangement solved the problem of noise in the morning, because he came in to bathe after preparing his class and made a sincere effort not to awaken his wife. They would often arrive at the bathroom at the same time, and then they took turns brushing their teeth before going to sleep. After 4 months had gone by, he lay down on their double bed one night to read until she came out of the bathroom, as he often did, and he fell asleep. She lay down beside him in a rather careless way so that he would wake up and leave. And in fact, he did stir. But instead of getting up, he turned out the light and settled himself on the pillow. She shook him by the shoulder to remind him that he was supposed to go to the study. But it felt so comfortable to be back in his great-grandparents' feather bed that he preferred to capitulate. "Let me stay here," he said. There was soap. When they recalled this episode, now they had rounded the corner of old age, neither could believe the astonishing truth that this had been the most serious argument in 50 years of living together, and the only one that had made them both want to abandon their responsibilities and begin a new life. Even when they were old and placid, they were careful about bringing it up, for the barely healed wounds could begin to bleed again, as if they had been inflicted only yesterday. He was the first man that Fermina Daza heard urinate. She heard him on their wedding night, while she lay prostrate with seasickness in the stateroom on the ship that was carrying them to France, and the sound of his stallion stream seemed so potent, so replete with authority, that it increased her terror of the devastation to come. That memory often returned to her as the years weakened the stream, for she could never resign herself to his wetting the rim of the toilet bowl each time he used it. Dr. Urbino tried to convince her, with arguments readily understandable to anyone who wished to understand them, that the mishap was not repeated every day through carelessness on his part, as she insisted, but because of organic reasons. As a young man, his stream was so defined and so direct that when he was at school, he won contests for marksmanship in filling bottles. But with the ravages of age, it was not only decreasing, it was also becoming oblique and scattered, and had at last turned into a fantastic fountain, impossible to control despite his many efforts to direct it. He would say, "The toilet must have been invented by someone who knew nothing about men." He contributed to domestic peace with a quotidian act that was more humiliating than humble. He wiped the rim of the bowl with toilet paper each time he used it. She knew, but never said anything as long as the ammoniac fumes were not too strong in the bathroom. And then she proclaimed, as if she had uncovered a crime, "This stinks like a rabbit hutch." On the eve of old age, this physical difficulty inspired Dr. Urbino with the ultimate solution. He urinated sitting down, as she did, which kept the bowl clean and him in a state of grace. By this time, he could do very little for himself, and the possibility of a fatal slip in the tub put him on his guard against the shower. The house was modern and did not have the pewter tub with lion's paw feet common in the mansions of the old city, He had had it removed for hygienic reasons. The bathtub was another piece of abominable junk invented by Europeans who bathed only on the last Friday of the month, and then in the same water made filthy by the very dirt they tried to remove from their bodies. So he had ordered an outsized washtub made of solid lignum vitae, in which Fermina Dasa bathed her husband just as if he were a newborn child. Waters boiled with mallow leaves and orange skins were mixed into the bath that lasted over an hour, and the effect on him was so sedative that he sometimes fell asleep in the perfumed infusion. After bathing him, Fermina Dasa helped him to dress. She sprinkled talcum powder between his legs. She smoothed cocoa butter on his rashes. She helped him put on his undershorts with as much love as if they had been a diaper, and continued dressing him, item by item, from his socks to the knot in his tie with the topaz pin. Their conjugal dawns grew calm because he had returned to the childhood his children had taken away from him. And she, in turn, at last accepted the domestic schedule because the years were passing for her, too. She slept less and less, and by the time she was 70, she was awake before her husband. On Pentecost Sunday, when he lifted the blanket to look at Jeremia de San Amor's body, Dr. Urbino experienced the revelation of something that had been denied him until then in his most lucid peregrinations as a physician and a believer. After so many years of familiarity with death, after battling it for so long, after so much turning it inside out and upside down, it was as if he had dared to look death in the face for the first time, and it had looked back at him. It was not the fear of death. No. That fear had been inside him for many years. It had lived with him. It had been another shadow cast over his own shadow ever since the night he awoke, shaken by a bad dream, and realized that death was not only a permanent probability, as he had always believed, but an immediate reality. What he had seen that day, however, was the physical presence of something that, until that moment, had been only an imagined certainty. He was very glad that the instrument used by divine providence for that overwhelming revelation had been Jeremia de San Amor, whom he had always considered a saint, unaware of his own state of grace. But when the letter revealed his true identity, his sinister past, his inconceivable powers of deception, he felt that something definitive and irrevocable had occurred in his life. Nevertheless, Fermina Dasa did not allow him to infect her with his somber mood. He tried, of course, while she helped him put his legs into his trousers and work the long row of buttons on his shirt. But he failed because Fermina Dasa was not easy to impress, least of all by the death of a man she did not care for. All she knew about him was that Jeremia de San Amor was a cripple on crutches whom she had never seen, that he had escaped the firing squad during one of many insurrections on one of many islands in the Antilles, that he had become a photographer of children out of necessity and had become the most successful one in the province, and that he had won a game of chess from someone she remembered as Torremolinos, but in reality was named Capablanca. But he was nothing more than a fugitive from Cayenne, condemned to life imprisonment for an atrocious crime, said Dr. Urbino. Imagine, he had even eaten human flesh. He handed her the letter whose secrets he wanted to carry with him to the grave, but she put the folded sheets in her dressing table without reading them, and locked the drawer with a key. She was accustomed to her husband's unfathomable capacity for astonishment, his exaggerated opinions that became more incomprehensible as the years went by, his narrowness of mind that was out of tune with his public image. But this time, he had outdone himself. She had supposed that her husband held Jeremia de San Amor in esteem not for what he had once been, but for what he began to be after he arrived here with only his exile's rucksack, and she could not understand why he was so distressed by the disclosure of his true identity at this late date. She did not comprehend why he thought it an abomination that he had had a woman in secret, since that was an atavistic custom of a certain kind of man, himself included, yes, even he, in a moment of ingratitude, and besides, it seemed to her a heartbreaking proof of love that she had helped him carry out his decision to die. She said, "If you also decided to do that for reasons as serious as his, my duty would be to do what she did." Once again, Dr. Urbino found himself face to face with the simple incomprehension that had exasperated him for half a century. "You don't understand anything," he said. "What infuriates me is not what he was or what he did, but the deception he practiced on all of us for so many years." His eyes began to fill with easy tears, but she pretended not to see. "He did the right thing," she replied. "If he had told the truth, not you or that poor woman or anybody in this town would have loved him as much as they did." She threaded his watch chain through the buttonhole in his vest. She put the finishing touches to the knot in his tie and pinned on his topaz tie-pin. Then she dried his eyes and wiped his teary beard with the handkerchief sprinkled with Florida water and put that in his breast pocket, its corners spread open like a magnolia. The 11 strokes of the pendulum clock sounded in the depths of the house. "Hurry," she said, taking him by the arm. "We'll be late." Aminta de Shams, Dr. Lacides Olivella's wife, and her 7 equally diligent daughters had arranged every detail so that the silver anniversary luncheon would be the social event of the year. The family home, in the very center of the historic district, was the old mint, denatured by a Florentine architect who came through here like an ill wind blowing renovation and converted many 17th-century relics into Venetian basilicas. It had 6 bedrooms and 2 large, well-ventilated dining and reception rooms, but that was not enough space for the guests from the city, not to mention the very select few from out of town. The patio was like an abbey cloister, with a stone fountain murmuring in the center and pots of heliotrope that perfumed the house at dusk, but the space among the arcades was inadequate for so many grand family names. So it was decided to hold the luncheon in their country house that was 10 minutes away by automobile along the King's Highway and had over an acre of patio and enormous Indian laurels and local water lilies in a gently flowing river. The men from Don Sancho's inn, under the supervision of Señora de Olivella, hung colored canvas awnings in the sunny areas and raised a platform under the laurels with tables for 122 guests, with a linen tablecloth on each of them and bouquets of the day's fresh roses for the table of honor. They also built a wooden dais for a woodwind band whose program was limited to contra dances and national waltzes, and for a string quartet from the School of Fine Arts, which was Señora de Olivella's surprise for her husband's venerable teacher, who would preside over the luncheon. Although the date did not correspond exactly to the anniversary of his graduation, they chose Pentecost Sunday in order to magnify the significance of the celebration. The preparations had begun 3 months earlier, for fear that something indispensable would be left undone for lack of time. They brought in live chickens from Ciénaga de Oro, famous all along the coast not only for their size and flavor, but because in colonial times they had scratched for food in alluvial deposits and little nuggets of pure gold were found in their gizzards. Señora de Olivella herself, accompanied by some of her daughters and her domestic staff, boarded the luxury ocean liners and selected the best from everywhere to honor her husband's achievements. She had anticipated everything, except that the celebration would take place on a Sunday in June, in a year when the rains were late. She realized the danger that very morning, when she went to high mass and was horrified by the humidity, and saw that the sky was heavy and low, and that one could not see to the ocean's horizon. Despite these ominous signs, the director of the astronomical observatory, whom she met at mass, reminded her that in all the troubled history of the city, even during the cruelest winters, it had never rained on Pentecost. Still, when the clock struck 12 and many of the guests were already having an aperitif outdoors. A single crash of thunder made the earth tremble, and a turbulent wind from the sea knocked over the tables and blew down the canopies, and the sky collapsed in a catastrophic downpour. In the chaos of the storm, Dr. Juvenal Urbino, along with the other late guests whom he had met on the road, had great difficulty reaching the house, and like them, he wanted to move from the carriage to the house by jumping from stone to stone across the mudded patio. But at last, he had to accept the humiliation of being carried by Don Sancho's men under a yellow canvas canopy. They did the best they could to set up the separate tables again inside the house, even in the bedrooms, and the guests made no effort to disguise their surly, shipwrecked mood. It was as hot as a ship's boiler room, for the windows had to be closed to keep out the wind-driven rain. In the patio, each place at the tables had been marked with a card bearing the name of the guest, one side reserved for men and the other for women, according to custom. But inside the house, the name cards were in confusion, and people sat where they could in an obligatory promiscuity that defied our social superstitions on at least this one occasion. In the midst of the cataclysm, Aminta de Oliveira seemed to be everywhere at once. Her hair soaking wet, and her splendid dress spattered with mud. But bearing up under the misfortune with the invincible smile, learned from her husband, that would give no quarter to adversity. With the help of her daughters, who were cut from the same cloth, she did everything possible to keep the places at the table of honor in order, with Dr. Juvenal Urbino in the center and Archbishop Obdulio Irrey on his right. Fermina Daza sat next to her husband, as she always did, for fear he would fall asleep during the meal or spill soup on his lapel. Across from him sat Dr. Lasides Oliveira, a well-preserved man of about 50, with an effeminate air, whose festive spirit seemed in no way related to his accurate diagnosis. The rest of the table was occupied by provincial and municipal officials, and last year's beauty queen, whom the governor escorted to the seat next to him. Although it was not customary for invitations to request special attire, least of all for a luncheon in the country, the women wore evening gowns and precious jewels, and most of the men were dressed in dinner jackets with black ties, and some even wore frock coats. Only the most sophisticated, Dr. Urbino among them, wore their ordinary clothes. At each place was a menu printed in French with golden vignettes. Señora de Oliveira, horror-struck by the devastating heat, went through the house pleading with the men to take off their jackets during the luncheon, but no one dared to be the first. The Archbishop commented to Dr. Urbino that in a sense this was a historic luncheon. There, together for the first time at the same table, their wounds healed and their anger dissipated, sat the two opposing sides in the civil wars that had bloodied the country ever since independence. This thought accorded with the enthusiasm of the liberals, especially the younger ones, who had succeeded in electing a president from their party after 45 years of conservative hegemony. Dr. Urbino did not agree. In his opinion, a liberal president was exactly the same as a conservative president, but not as well-dressed. But he did not want to contradict the Archbishop, although he would have liked to point out to him that guests were at that luncheon not because of what they thought, but because of the merits of their lineage, which was something that had always stood over and above the hazards of politics and the horrors of war. From this point of view, in fact, not a single person was missing. The downpour ended as suddenly as it had begun, and the sun began to shine in a cloudless sky, but the storm had been so violent that several trees were uprooted, and the overflowing stream had turned the patio into a swamp. The greatest disaster had occurred in the kitchen. Wood fires had been built outdoors on bricks behind the house, and the cooks barely had time to rescue their pots from the rain. They lost precious time reorganizing the flooded kitchen and improvising new fires in the back gallery. But by 1 o'clock, the crisis had been resolved, and only the dessert was missing. The Sisters of St. Clair were in charge of that, and they had promised to send it before 11. It was feared that the ditch along the King's Highway had flooded, as it did even in less severe winters, and in that case, it would be at least 2 hours before the dessert arrived. As soon as the weather cleared, they opened the windows, and the house was cooled by air that had been purified by the sulphurous storm. Then the band was told to play its program of waltzes on the terrace of the portico, and that only heightened the confusion because everyone had to shout to be heard over the banging of copper pots inside the house. Tired of waiting, smiling, even on the verge of tears, Aminta de Oliveira ordered luncheon to be served. The group from the School of Fine Arts began their concert in the formal silence achieved for the opening bars of Mozart's La Chasse. Despite the voices that grew louder and more confused, and the intrusions of Don Sancho's black servants, who could barely squeeze past the tables with their steaming serving dishes, Dr. Urbino managed to keep a channel open to the music until the program was over. His powers of concentration had decreased so much with the passing years that he had to write down each chess move in order to remember what he had planned. Yet he could still engage in serious conversation and follow a concert at the same time, although he never reached the masterful extremes of a German orchestra conductor, a great friend of his during his time in Austria, who read the score of Don Giovanni while listening to Tannhäuser. He thought that the second piece on the program, Schubert's Death and the Maiden, was played with facile theatricality. While he strained to listen through the clatter of covered dishes, he stared at a blushing boy who nodded to him in greeting. He had seen him somewhere, no doubt about that, but he could not remember where. This often happened to him, above all with people's names, even those he knew well, or with a melody from other times, and it caused him such dreadful anguish that one night he would have preferred to die rather than endure it until dawn. He was on the verge of reaching that state now, when a charitable flash illuminated his memory. The boy had been one of his students last year. He was surprised to see him there, in the kingdom of the elect. But Dr. Oliveira reminded him that he was the son of the Minister of Health and was preparing a thesis in forensic medicine. Dr. Juvenal Urbino greeted him with a joyful wave of his hand, and the young doctor stood up and responded with a bow. But not then, not ever, did he realize that this was the intern who had been with him that morning in the house of Jeremia de San Amor. Comforted by yet another victory over old age, he surrendered to the diaphanous and fluid lyricism of the final piece on the program, which he could not identify. Later, the young cellist, who had just returned from France, told him it was a quartet for strings by Gabriel Fauré, whom Dr. Urbino had not even heard of, although he was always very alert to the latest trends in Europe. Fermina Daza, who was keeping an eye on him as she always did, but most of all when she saw him becoming introspective in public, stopped eating and put her earthly hand on his. She said, "Don't think about it anymore." Dr. Urbino smiled at her from the far shore of ecstasy, and it was then that he began to think again about what she had feared. He remembered Jeremia de San Amor, on view at that hour in his coffin, in his bogus military uniform with his fake decorations under the accusing eyes of the children in the portraits. He turned to the archbishop to tell him about the suicide, but he had already heard the news. There had been a good deal of talk after High Mass, and he had even received a request from General Jerónimo Argote on behalf of the Caribbean refugees that he be buried in holy ground. He said, "The request itself, it seemed to me, showed a lack of respect." Then, in a more humane tone, he asked if anyone knew the reason for the suicide. Dr. Urbino answered, "Gerontophobia." The proper word, although he thought he had just invented it. Dr. Oliveira, attentive to the guests who were sitting closest to him, stopped listening to them for a moment to take part in his teacher's conversation. He said, "It is a pity to still find a suicide that is not for love." Dr. Urbino was not surprised to recognize his own thoughts in those of his favorite disciple. "And worse yet," he said, "with gold cyanide." When he said that, he once again felt compassion prevailing over the bitterness caused by the letter, for which he thanked not his wife, but rather a miracle of the music. Then he spoke to the archbishop of the lay saint he had known in their long twilights of chess. He spoke of the dedication of his art to the happiness of children, his rare erudition in all things of this world, his Spartan habits, and he himself was surprised by the purity of soul with which Jeremiah de San Amor had separated himself once and for all from his past. Then he spoke to the mayor about the advantages of purchasing his files of photographic plates in order to preserve the images of a generation who might never again be happy outside their portraits, and in whose hands lay the future of the city. The archbishop was scandalized that a militant and educated Catholic would dare to think that a suicide was saintly, but he agreed with the plan to create an archive of the negatives. The mayor wanted to know from whom they were to be purchased. Dr. Urbino's tongue burned with the live coal of the secret. "I will take care of it." And he felt redeemed by his own loyalty to the woman he had repudiated 5 hours earlier. Fermina Daza noticed it, and in a low voice made him promise that he would attend the funeral. Relieved, he said that of course he would. That went without saying. The speeches were brief and simple. The woodwind band began a popular tune that had not been announced on the program, and the guests strolled along the terraces, waiting for the men from Don Sancho's inn to finish drying the patio in case anyone felt inclined to dance. The only guests who stayed in the drawing room were those at the table of honor, who were celebrating the fact that Dr. Urbino had drunk half a glass of brandy in one swallow in a final toast. No one recalled that he had already done the same thing with a glass of Grand Cru wine as accompaniment to a very special dish, but his heart had demanded it of him that afternoon, and his self-indulgence was well repaid. Once again, after so many long years, he felt like singing. And he would have, no doubt, on the urging of the young cellist who offered to accompany him, if one of those new automobiles had not suddenly driven across the mudhole of the patio, splashing the musicians and rousing the ducks in the barnyards with the quacking of its horn. It stopped in front of the portico, and Dr. Marco Aurelio Urbino Daza and his wife emerged, laughing for all they were worth and carrying a tray covered with lace cloths in each hand. Other trays just like them were on the jump seats and even on the floor next to the chauffeur. It was the belated dessert. When the applause and the shouted cordial jokes had ended, Dr. Urbino Daza explained in all seriousness that before the storm broke, the Sisters of St. Clair had asked him to please bring the dessert, but he had left the King's Highway because someone said that his parents' house was on fire. Dr. Juvenal Urbino became upset before his son could finish the story, but his wife reminded him in time that he himself had called for the firemen to rescue the parrot. Aminta de Oliveira was radiant as she decided to serve the dessert on the terraces, even though they had already had their coffee. But Dr. Juvenal Urbino and his wife left without tasting it, for there was barely enough time for him to have his sacred siesta before the funeral. And he did have it, although his sleep was brief and restless, because he discovered when he returned home that the firemen had caused almost as much damage as a fire. In their efforts to frighten the parrot, they had stripped a tree with the pressure hoses, and a misdirected jet of water through the windows of the master bedroom had caused irreparable damage to the furniture and to the portraits of unknown forebears hanging on the walls. Thinking that there really was a fire, the neighbors had hurried over when they heard the bell on the fire truck, and if the disturbance was no worse, it was because the schools were closed on Sundays. When they realized they could not reach the parrot, even with their extension ladders, the firemen began to chop at the branches with machetes, and only the opportune arrival of Dr. Urbino Daza prevented them from mutilating the tree all the way to the trunk. They left, saying they would return after 5 o'clock if they received permission to prune, and on their way out they muddied the interior terrace and the drawing room and ripped Fermina Daza's favorite Turkish rug. Needless disasters, all of them, because the general impression was that the parrot had taken advantage of the chaos to escape through neighboring patios. And in fact, Dr. Urbino looked for him in the foliage, but there was no response in any language, not even to whistles and songs. So he gave him up for lost and went to sleep when it was almost 3 o'clock. But first, he enjoyed the immediate pleasure of smelling a secret garden in his urine that had been purified by lukewarm asparagus. He was awakened by sadness. Not the sadness he had felt that morning when he stood before the corpse of his friend, but the invisible cloud that would saturate his soul after his siesta, and which he interpreted as divine notification that he was living his final afternoons. Until the age of 50, he had not been conscious of the size and weight and condition of his organs. Little by little, as he lay with his eyes closed after his daily siesta, he had begun to feel them, one by one, inside his body. Feel the shape of his insomniac heart, his mysterious liver, his hermetic pancreas. And he had slowly discovered that even the oldest people were younger than he was, and that he had become the only survivor of his generation's legendary group portraits. When he became aware of his first bouts of forgetfulness, he had recourse to a tactic he had heard about from one of his teachers at the medical school. The man who has no memory makes one out of paper. But this was a short-lived illusion, for he had reached the stage where he would forget what the written reminders in his pocket meant, search the entire house for the eyeglasses he was wearing, turn the key again after locking the doors, and lose the sense of what he was reading because he forgot the premise of the argument or the relationships among the characters. But what disturbed him most was his lack of confidence in his own power of reason. Little by little, as in an ineluctable shipwreck, he felt himself losing his good judgment. With no scientific basis except his own experience, Dr. Juvenal Urbino knew that most fatal diseases had their own specific odor, but that none was as specific as old age. He detected it in the cadavers slid open from head to toe on the dissecting table. He even recognized it in patients who hid their age with the greatest success. He smelled it in the perspiration on his own clothing and in the unguarded breathing of his sleeping wife. If he had not been what he was, in essence an old-style Christian, perhaps he would have agreed with Jeremiah de San Amor that old age was an indecent state that had to be ended before it was too late. The only consolation, even for someone like him who had been a good man in bed, was sexual peace, the slow, merciful extinction of his venereal appetite. At 81 years of age, he had enough lucidity to realize that he was attached to this world by a few slender threads that could break painlessly with a simple change of position while he slept. And if he did all he could to keep those threads intact, it was because of his terror of not finding God in the darkness of death. Fermina Daza had been busy straightening the bedroom that had been destroyed by the firemen, and a little before 4, she sent for her husband's daily glass of lemonade with chipped ice and reminded him that he should dress for the funeral. That afternoon, Dr. Urbino had 2 books by his hand, Man, the Unknown, by Alexis Carrel, and The Story of San Michel, by Axel Monta. The pages of the 2nd book were still uncut, and he asked Dina Pardo, the cook, to bring him the marble paper cutter he had left in the bedroom. But when it was brought to him, he was already reading Man, the Unknown, at the place he had marked with an envelope. There were only a few pages left till the end. He read slowly, making his way through the meanderings of a slight headache that he attributed to the half glass of brandy at the final toast. When he paused in his reading, he sipped the lemonade or took his time chewing on a piece of ice. He was wearing his socks and his shirt without its starched collar. His elastic suspenders with the green stripes hung down from his waist. The mere idea of having to change for the funeral irritated him. Soon he stopped reading, placed one book on top of the other, and began to rock very slowly in the wicker rocking chair, contemplating with regret the banana plants in the mire of the patio, the stripped mango, the flying ants that came after the rain, the ephemeral splendor of another afternoon that would never return. He had forgotten that he ever owned a parrot from Paramaribo, whom he loved as if he were a human being, when suddenly he heard him say,
"Royal parrot!"
His voice sounded close by, almost next to him. And then he saw him in the lowest branch of the mango tree.
"You scoundrel!" he shouted.
The parrot answered in an identical voice,
"You're even more of a scoundrel, doctor."
He continued to talk to him, keeping him in view while he put on his boots with great care so as not to frighten him, and pulled his suspenders up over his arms and went down to the patio, which was still full of mud, testing the ground with his stick so that he would not trip on the three steps of the terrace. The parrot did not move, and perched so close to the ground that Dr. Urbino held out his walking stick for him so that he could sit on the silver handle, as was his custom. But the parrot sidestepped and jumped to the next branch, a little higher up but easier to reach since the house ladder had been leaning against it even before the arrival of the firemen. Dr. Urbino calculated the height and thought that if he climbed two rungs, he would be able to catch him. He stepped onto the first, singing a disarming, friendly song to distract the attention of the churlish bird, who repeated the words without the music, but sidled still farther out on the branch. He climbed to the second rung without difficulty, holding on to the ladder with both hands, and the parrot began to repeat the entire song without moving from the spot. He climbed to the third rung, and then the fourth, for he had miscalculated the height of the branch. And then he grasped the ladder with his left hand and tried to seize the parrot with his right. Vina Pardo, the old servant, who was coming to remind him that he would be late for the funeral, saw the back of a man standing on the ladder, and she would not have believed that he was who he was if it had not been for the green stripes on the elastic suspenders.
"Santissimo Sacramento!" she shrieked. "You'll kill yourself!"
Dr. Urbino caught the parrot around the neck with a triumphant sigh.
Sigh-ye!
But he released him immediately because the ladder slipped from under his feet, and for an instant he was suspended in air. And then he realized that he had died without communion, without time to repent of anything or to say goodbye to anyone, at 4:07 on Pentecost Sunday. Fermina Vasa was in the kitchen tasting the soup for supper when she heard Dina Pardo's horrified shriek and the shouting of the servants and then of the entire neighborhood. She dropped the tasting spoon and tried her best to run, despite the invincible weight of her age, screaming like a madwoman without knowing yet what had happened under the mango leaves, and her heart jumped inside her ribs when she saw her man lying on his back in the mud, dead to this life, but still resisting death's final blow for one last minute so that she would have time to come to him. He recognized her, despite the uproar, through his tears of unrepeatable sorrow at dying without her, and he looked at her for the last and final time with eyes more luminous, more grief-stricken, more grateful than she had ever seen them in half a century of a shared life. And he managed to say to her with his last breath, "Only God knows how much I loved you." It was a memorable death, and not without reason. Soon after he had completed his course of specialized studies in France, Dr. Juvenal Urbino became known in his country for the drastic new methods he used to ward off the last cholera epidemic suffered by the province. While he was still in Europe, the previous one had caused the death of a quarter of the urban population in less than 3 months. Among the victims was his father, who was also a highly esteemed physician. With his immediate prestige and a sizable contribution from his own inheritance, he founded the Medical Society, the first and for many years the only one in the Caribbean provinces, of which he was lifetime president. He organized the construction of the first aqueduct, the first sewer system, and the covered public market that permitted filth to be cleaned out of Las Animas Bay. He was also president of the Academy of the Language and the Academy of History. For his service to the church, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem made him a Knight of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, and the French government conferred upon him the rank of commander in the Legion of Honor. He gave active encouragement to every religious and civic society in the city, and had a special interest in the Patriotic Junta, composed of politically disinterested influential citizens who urged governments and local businesses to adopt progressive ideas that were too daring for the time. The most memorable of them was the testing of an aerostatic balloon that on its inaugural flight carried a letter to San Juan de la Cienega, long before anyone had thought of airmail as a rational possibility. The Center for the Arts, which was also his idea, established the School of Fine Arts in the same house where it is still located, and for many years he was a patron of the Poetic Festival in April. Only he achieved what it seemed impossible for at least a century, the restoration of the dramatic theater, which had been used as a hen house and a breeding farm for gamecocks since colonial times. It was the culmination of a spectacular civic campaign that involved every sector of the city in a multitudinous mobilization that many thought worthy of a better cause. In any event, the new dramatic theater was inaugurated when it still lacked seats or lights, and the audience had to bring their own chairs and their own lighting for the intermissions. The same protocol held sway as at the great performances in Europe, and the ladies used the occasion to show off their long dresses and their fur coats in the dog days of the Caribbean summer. But it was also necessary to authorize the admission of servants to carry the chairs and lamps and all the things to eat that were deemed necessary to survive the interminable programs, one of which did not end until it was time for early mass. The season opened with a French opera company, whose novelty was a harp in the orchestra, and whose unforgettable glory was the impeccable voice and dramatic talent of a Turkish soprano, who sang barefoot and wore rings set with precious stones on her toes. After the first act, the stage could barely be seen, and the singers lost their voices because of the smoke from so many palm oil lamps. But the chroniclers of the city were very careful to delete these minor inconveniences and to magnify the memorable events. Without a doubt, it was Dr. Urbino's most contagious initiative, for opera fever infected the most surprising elements in the city, and gave rise to a whole generation of Isoldes and Othellos and Aidas and Siegfrieds. But it never reached the extremes Dr. Urbino had hoped for, which was to see Italianizers and Wagnerians confronting each other with sticks and canes during the intermissions. Dr. Juvenal Urbino never accepted the public positions that were offered to him with frequency and without conditions, and he was a pitiless critic of those physicians who used their professional prestige to attain political office. Although he was always considered a liberal and was in the habit of voting for that party's candidates, it was more a question of tradition than conviction, and he was perhaps the last member of the great families who still knelt in the street when the archbishop's carriage drove by. He defined himself as a natural pacifist, a partisan of definitive reconciliation between liberals and conservatives for the good of the nation. But his public conduct was so autonomous that no group claimed him for its own. The liberals considered him a Gothic troglodyte, the conservatives said he was almost a Mason, and the Masons repudiated him as a secret cleric in the service of the Holy See. His less savage critics thought he was just an aristocrat enraptured by the delights of the poetic festival, while the nation bled to death in an endless civil war. Only two of his actions did not seem to conform to this image. The first was his leaving the former palace of the Marquis de Casalduero, which had been the family mansion for over a century, and moving to a new house in a neighborhood of Nouveau Riche. The other was his marriage to a beauty from the lower classes, without name or fortune, whom the ladies with long last names ridiculed in secret until they were forced to admit that she outshone them all in distinction and character. Dr. Urbino was always acutely aware of these and many other cracks in his public image, and no one was as conscious as he of being the last to bear a family name on its way to extinction. His children were two undistinguished ends of a line. After 50 years, his son, Marco Aurelio, a doctor like himself, and like all the family's firstborn sons in every generation, had done nothing worthy of note. He had not even produced a child. Dr. Urbino's only daughter, Ophelia, was married to a solid bank employee from New Orleans, and had reached the climacteric with 3 daughters and no son. But although stemming the flow of his blood into the tide of history caused him pain, what worried Dr. Urbino most about dying was the solitary life Fermina Daza would lead without him. In any event, the tragedy not only caused an uproar among his own household, but spread to the common people as well. They thronged the street in the hope of seeing something, even if it was only the brilliance of the legend. 3 days of mourning were proclaimed. Flags were flown at half-mast in public buildings, and the bells in all the churches tolled without pause until the crypt in the family mausoleum was sealed. A group from the School of Fine Arts made a death mask that was to be used as the mold for a life-size bust, but the project was cancelled because no one thought the faithful rendering of his final terror was decent. A renowned artist, who happened to be stopping here on his way to Europe, painted, with pathos-laden realism, a gigantic canvas in which Dr. Urbino was depicted on the ladder at the fatal moment when he stretched out his hand to capture the parrot. The only element that contradicted the raw truth of the story was that in the painting he was wearing not the collarless shirt and the suspenders with green stripes, but rather a bowler hat and black frock coat, copied from a rotogravure made during the years of the cholera epidemic. So that everyone would have the chance to see it, the painting was exhibited for a few months after the tragedy in the vast gallery of the Golden Wire, a shop that sold imported merchandise, and the entire city filed by. Then it was displayed on the walls of all the public and private institutions that felt obliged to pay tribute to the memory of their illustrious patron, and at last it was hung, after a second funeral, in the School of Fine Arts, where it was pulled down many years later by art students who burned it in the plaza of the university as a symbol of an aesthetic and a time they despised. From her first moment as a widow, it was obvious that Fermina Daza was not as helpless as her husband had feared. She was adamant in her determination not to allow the body to be used for any cause, and she remained so even after the honorific telegram from the President of the Republic ordering it to lie in state for public viewing in the assembly chamber of the provincial government. With the same serenity, she opposed a vigil in the cathedral, which the archbishop himself had requested, and she agreed to the bodies lying there only during the funeral mass. Even after the mediation of her son, who was dumbfounded by so many different requests, Fermina Daza was firm in her rustic notion that the dead belong only to the family, and that the vigil would be kept at home, with mountain coffee and fritters, and everyone free to weep for him in any way they chose. There would be no traditional 9-night wake. The doors were closed after the funeral and did not open again except for visits from intimate friends. The house was under the rule of death. Every object of value had been locked away with care for safekeeping, and on the bare walls there were only the outlines of the pictures that had been taken down. Chairs from the house and those lent by the neighbors were lined up against the walls from the drawing room to the bedrooms, and the empty spaces seemed immense, and the voices had a ghostly resonance because the large pieces of furniture had been moved to one side, except for the concert piano, which stood in its corner under a white sheet. In the middle of the library, on his father's desk, what had once been Juvenal Urbino de la Calle was laid out with no coffin, with his final terror petrified on his face,
and with the black cape and military sword of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre. At his side, in complete mourning, tremulous, hardly moving, but very much in control of herself, Fermina Daza received condolences, with no great display of feeling, until 11 the following morning, when she bade farewell to her husband from the portico, waving goodbye with a handkerchief. It had not been easy for her to regain her self-control after she heard Dina Pardo's shriek in the patio and found the old man of her life dying in the mud. Her first reaction was one of hope, because his eyes were open and shining with a radiant light she had never seen there before. She prayed to God to give him at least a moment so that he would not go without knowing how much she had loved him, despite all their doubts, and she felt an irresistible longing to begin life with him over again, so that they could say what they had left unsaid and do everything right that they had done badly in the past. But she had to give in to the intransigence of death. Her grief exploded into a blind rage against the world, even against herself, and that is what filled her with the control and the courage to face her solitude alone. From that time on she had no peace, but she was careful about any gesture that might seem to betray her grief. The only moment of pathos, although it was involuntary, occurred at 11 o'clock Sunday night when they brought in the Episcopal coffin, still smelling of ship's wax, with its copper handles and tufted silk lining. Dr. Urbino Daza ordered it closed without delay, since the air in the house was already rarefied with the heady fragrance of so many flowers and the sweltering heat, and he thought he had seen the first purplish shadows on his father's neck. An absent-minded voice was heard in the silence. At that age, you're half-decayed while you're still alive. Before they closed the coffin, Fermina Daza took off her wedding ring and put it on her dead husband's finger, and then she covered his hand with hers, as she always did when she caught him digressing in public. "We will see each other very soon," she said to him. Florentino Ariza, unseen in the crowd of notable personages, felt a piercing pain in his side. Fermina Daza had not recognized him in the confusion of the first condolences, although no one would be more ready to serve or more useful during the night's urgent business. It was he who imposed order in the crowded kitchens so that there would be enough coffee. He found additional chairs when the neighbors proved insufficient, and he ordered the extra reeds to be put in the patio when there was no more room in the house. He made certain there was enough brandy for Dr. Lacides Oliveira's guests, who had heard the bad news at the height of the silver anniversary celebration and had rushed in to continue the party, sitting in a circle under the mango tree. He was the only one who knew how to react when the fugitive parrot appeared in the dining room at midnight, with his head high and his wings spread, which caused a stupefied shudder to run through the house, for it seemed a sign of repentance. Florentino Ariza seized him by the neck before he had time to shout any of his witless stock phrases, and he carried him to the stable in a covered cage. He did everything this way, with so much discretion and such efficiency, that it did not even occur to anyone that it might be an intrusion in other people's affairs. On the contrary, it seemed a priceless service when evil times had fallen on the house. He was what he seemed, a useful and serious old man. His body was bony and erect, his skin dark and clean-shaven, his eyes avid behind round spectacles in silver frames, and he wore a romantic, old-fashioned mustache with waxed tips. He combed the last tufts of hair at his temples upward and plastered them with brilliantine to the middle of his shining skull as a solution to total baldness. His natural gallantry and languid manner were immediately charming, but they were also considered suspect virtues in a confirmed bachelor. He had spent a great deal of money, ingenuity, and willpower to disguise the 76 years he had completed in March, and he was convinced in the solitude of his soul that he had loved in silence for a much longer time than anyone else in this world ever had. The night of Dr. Urbino's death, he was dressed just as he had been when he first heard the news, which was how he always dressed, even in the infernal heat of June. A dark suit with a vest, a silk bow tie and a celluloid collar, a felt hat, and a shiny black umbrella that he also used as a walking stick. But when it began to grow light, he left the vigil for 2 hours and returned as fresh as the rising sun, carefully shaven and fragrant with lotions from his dressing table. He had changed into a black frock coat of the kind worn only for funerals and the offices of Holy Week, a wing collar with an artist's bow instead of a tie, and a bowler hat. He also carried his umbrella, not just out of habit, but because he was certain that it would rain before noon, and he informed Dr. Urbino Vasa of this in case the funeral could be held earlier. They tried to do so, in fact, because Florentino Ariza belonged to a shipping family and was himself president of the River Company of the Caribbean, which allowed one to suppose that he knew something about predicting the weather. But they could not alter the arrangements in time with the civil and military authorities, the public and private corporations, the military band, the School of Fine Arts Orchestra, and the schools and religious fraternities, which were prepared for 11 o'clock. So the funeral that had been anticipated as a historic event turned into a rout because of a devastating downpour. Very few people splashed through the mud to the family mausoleum, protected by a colonial ceiba tree whose branches spread over the cemetery wall. On the previous afternoon, under those same branches, but in the section on the other side of the wall reserved for suicides, the Caribbean refugees had buried Jeremia de San Amor with his dog beside him, as he had requested. Florentino Ariza was one of the few who stayed until the funeral was over. He was soaked to the skin and returned home terrified that he would catch pneumonia after so many years of meticulous care and excessive precautions. He prepared hot lemonade with a shot of brandy, drank it in bed with 2 aspirin tablets, and, wrapped in a wool blanket, sweated by the bucketful until the proper equilibrium had been re-established in his body. When he returned to the wake, he felt his vitality completely restored. Fermina Vasa had once again assumed command of the house, which was cleaned and ready to receive visitors. And on the altar in the library, she had placed a portrait in pastels of her dead husband, with a black border around the frame. By 8 o'clock, there were as many people and as intense a heat as the night before. But after the rosary, someone circulated the request that everyone leave early so that the widow could rest for the first time since Sunday afternoon. Fermina Vasa said goodbye to most of them at the altar, but she accompanied the last group of intimate friends to the street door so that she could lock it herself, as she had always done, as she was prepared to do with her final breath, when she saw Florentino Ariza, dressed in mourning and standing in the middle of the deserted drawing room. She was pleased, because for many years she had erased him from her life, and this was the first time she saw him clearly, purified by forgetfulness. But before she could thank him for the visit, he placed his hat over his heart, tremulous and dignified, and the abscess that had sustained his life finally burst. "Fermina," he said, "I have waited for this opportunity for more than half a century, to repeat to you once again my vow of eternal fidelity and everlasting love." Fermina Vasa would have thought she was facing a madman if she had not had reason to believe that at that moment Florentino Ariza was inspired by the grace of the Holy Spirit. Her first impulse was to curse him for profaning the house when the body of her husband was still warm in the grave. But the dignity of her fury held her back. "Get out of here," she said, "and don't show your face again for the years of life that are left to you." She opened the street door, which she had begun to close, and concluded, "And I hope there are very few of them." When she heard his steps fade away in the deserted street, she closed the door very slowly with the crossbar in the locks and faced her destiny alone. Until that moment, She had never been fully conscious of the weight and size of the drama that she had provoked when she was not yet 18, and that would pursue her until her death. She wept for the first time since the afternoon of the disaster, without witnesses, which was the only way she wept. She wept for the death of her husband, for her solitude and rage, and when she went into the empty bedroom, she wept for herself, because she had rarely slept alone in that bed since the loss of her virginity. Everything that belonged to her husband made her weep again. His tasseled slippers, his pajamas under the pillow, the space of his absence in the dressing table mirror, his own odor on her skin. A vague thought made her shudder. The people one loves should take all their things with them when they die. She did not want anyone's help to get ready for bed. She did not want to eat anything before she went to sleep. Crushed by grief, she prayed to God to send her death that night while she slept, and with that hope she lay down, barefoot but fully dressed, and fell asleep on the spot. She slept without realizing it, but she knew in her sleep that she was still alive, and that she had half a bed to spare, and that she was lying on her left side on the left-hand side of the bed as she always did, but that she missed the weight of the other body on the other side. Thinking as she slept, she thought that she would never again be able to sleep this way, and she began to sob in her sleep, and she slept, sobbing, without changing position on her side of the bed, until long after the roosters crowed, and she was awakened by the despised son of the morning without him. Only then did she realize that she had slept a long time without dying, sobbing in her sleep, and that while she slept, sobbing, she had thought more about Florentino Arisa than about her dead husband. Florentino Arisa, on the other hand, had not stopped thinking of her for a single moment since Fermina Daza had rejected him out of hand after a long and troubled love affair, 51 years, 9 months, and 4 days ago. He did not have to keep a running